Happy first Sunday of Advent. It's officially here. It's hard to believe that it feels like it was just January 11 months ago. But we're here, and we are starting a new series this morning entitled Words. If you were with us on Wednesday night, Matt and I online, we've been talking about this the last couple weeks too. As we journey toward Christmas, you know, we all know the words of Advent. We've talked about one already, hope. Hope and peace and joy and love. And I think it's pretty safe, as I said this on Wednesday night, it's pretty safe to say that those are things that we all long for as living. We want those as realities in our lives. Like I said, you know, without hope, it's hard to get yourself going. And we all want to experience peace in our lives and joy, and we want to be loved, and we want to be able to give love. But, and I don't say this, I'm not trying to be cynical when I say this, but it just seems the more and more we look around in our world, the more and more those are in short supply. But we are, as I said, as we journey toward Christmas, we're going to take a look at these four words through specifically the eyes of Isaiah, as he, under the direction and inspiration of the Holy Spirit, looked forward to one who was coming, who would be the fulfillment of the truest and deepest meaning of all of these words. Now, these aren't the only words we talk about at Christmas or at Advent, but these seem to be the four that we just focus in on. Hope and peace and joy and love. And of course, we all know, no spoilers here, we all know who Isaiah was looking forward to. It was Jesus the Christ. And to put this kind of in historical context for us, because I like doing stuff like that, Isaiah lived a few years before Jesus, 700 to be exact. Now, if you want to put that in your mind, what that looks like, the Revolutionary War was just about 250 years ago. That is just over a third of the time between Isaiah and Jesus. So it wasn't just like Isaiah was saying in 1 BC, there is coming one... No, there was a few years that had to transpire and had to pass. But even seven centuries before, and really we've talked about this, all the way back to the dawn of creation, God had a plan to bring one into the world who would fix everything that broke in the garden. And that's what we're talking about in the series, is how he does that. And so it's also important to understand when we read the prophets, when you read Isaiah and Jeremiah and Ezekiel, it can be kind of tricky because those aren't really narratives. They're not really telling a story, but each one of those prophets ministered during a particular window of time, in particular specific situations. They were prophesying to specific nations. And if you want to have a window over these 4 weeks into the environment that Isaiah was ministering in, I mentioned this Wednesday night, but you can read 2 Chronicles 26 through 32 and 2 Kings 15 through 20. That's what was going on during the time of the book of Isaiah. And if you read that, it doesn't take very long for you to start thinking, boy, the words hope, peace, joy, and love just do not seem like they fit in this story. But time after time after time, Isaiah reminds the people, and he reminds us by extension, how they do fit in the story of God. And just like every other era of history in the people of God and the people of Israel, they were under threat. In 1 Samuel, we were just talking about the annoying Philistines who just wouldn't go away. They kept attacking and goading the Israelites on to their own demise. And just like then, during this time, Israel is in danger of being attacked. In fact, they have danger inside and outside, because by this time, it's a divided kingdom. You have Israel in the north, Judah in the south, and there's this big empire just above both of them by the name of Assyria, who's being ruled by a egomaniac dictator who has designs on taking over the world, and he has a military plan to do so that's going to take him right through Israel and Judah. And Isaiah is called by God to be a prophet as a very young man during this time, about 18 years before Assyria starts to pull that off. And about 18 years after Isaiah's call, we see Assyria come in and they overtake Israel. And that begins the Assyrian captivity, where the northern kingdom of Israel is taken into captivity and sent into exile. And then in Isaiah 6, he prophesies that, Isaiah 6, he prophesies, Isaiah 6. Getting my chapters mixed up here. Isaiah 6, he prophesies that Judah would suffer the same fate that Israel did, but it would be Babylon that would come in and overtake them into captivity. And you can read about that in Daniel. That's a lot of what happened. So Israel is sitting in between kind of the nation of Israel, Judah and Israel are sitting in between these two superpowers, and eventually both of them will be captured. Both of them will be removed from their homelands and will be sent into captivity. And that is the environment that Isaiah is called. The Babylonian captivity came a few years after Isaiah was around, about 100 years later. But that's the environment that Isaiah is ministering in, that he's called to be a prophet in. But he consistently and continually reminds the people that God had a plan to eventually rescue them. In fact, in chapter 10, this is where I was getting my chapters mixed up, he prophesies that Assyria is going to be punished, basically, for what they've done, and that they would be destroyed and turned into a nation of stumps. Stumps that would never, ever come back to life, but for the people of God, a very different thing would happen. They would be reduced to stumps, but out of that stump would come a shoot. Out of the root of Jesse, the father of King David. Out of that stump would come one who would grow and ultimately change the world. That was the future hope that they were called to live into and live in while they were carried away from their home countries, from their homes. Judah into Babylonian captivity, Israel into Assyrian captivity. That was the hope that they were to live in. And we are starting our Advent journey really where Israel needed to start theirs, and that's with hope. It's fitting that you'll see, depending on whose calendar it is or how they've arranged the Advent candles or themes, that the next 3 weeks you'll see in all sorts of orders. It'll be joy, peace, love, hope always starts. And it's because that's where we need to begin, is with hope. Now, the hope that we're talking about, though, is probably something very different than what we normally associate and what the world would define as hope. How the world would define hope typically has some disclaimers with it and is many times uncertain. In fact, it was interesting, Merriam-Webster defines the word hope this way: to want something to happen or be true, to long for something good, and here's the kicker, that may never occur. Those four little words at the end of that definition, that may never occur. Even there's an acknowledgement in the way that the world defines hope that what you're hoping for might not ever occur, but what we're talking about is not uncertain. When we hope as the people of God, when we put our hope in one of God's good promises, it is never uncertain. It might not feel like it's ever going to come, but it's never uncertain. That is biblical hope, holding on to God's promises with confidence because we are convinced that someday God will fulfill what He's promised. And we don't have that hope without context because we've seen over and over and over again how God has delivered on His promises. And that little stump or that little shoot that's going to come out of the stump that we're going to talk about, that's the yes to every single one of God's promises. That is our hope. And the season of Advent is all about living day by day with this eager expectation of God to fulfill the promises that He has made to us, to come into our world and into our lives and make everything right, as He defines what's right. That's what Advent is about. It's this expectation of arrival. In fact, that's what the word Advent means, an arrival, to arrive. We're awaiting this promise of the arrival of Jesus. Now, that arrival that we're talking about took place 2,000 years ago. You think 700 years is a long time? Think about 2,000. When God entered into the world personally in that little baby born in Bethlehem, and began the work of fixing everything that has been broken. But we don't just look back at that first arrival during Advent. We also look forward to the second arrival, where God is going to make good ultimately on every single one. You know, there's a sense in which God has already made good on His promises. We just haven't seen it yet. It's just like an author, C.S. Lewis talks about this, it's like an author outside of the story. The conclusion's already been written. We just have to live to the end of the book. God has already finished His work. We just have to get to the end of the story. We know, you know, we look at the back of the book, you know who wins. God's the hero. And so that's what Advent is all about. And today we remember 2,000 years ago this child that was born to a poor family, to no status the way the world defines status, but would ultimately be the one on whom the calendar hinges. You realize we define time by this little baby that was born in a nowhere village to a family that nobody had heard of. That's incredible to me. That's what we celebrate at Advent. So let's see what Isaiah the prophet foresaw about this shoot, this child. And we're going to be in Isaiah chapter 11. We're going to be reading the first 9 verses. Isaiah chapter 11, beginning at verse 1. Out of the stump of David's family will grow a shoot, yes, a new branch bearing fruit from the old root, and the Spirit of the Lord will rest on him, the Spirit of wisdom and understanding, the Spirit of counsel and might, the Spirit of knowledge and fear of the Lord. He will delight in obeying the Lord. He will not judge by appearance, nor make a decision based on hearsay. He will give justice to the poor and make fair decisions for the exploited. The earth will shake at the force of His word, and one breath from His mouth will destroy the wicked. He will wear righteousness like a belt, and truth like an undergarment. In that day the wolf and the lamb will live together. The leopard will lie down with the baby goat, the calf and the yearling will be safe with the lion, and a little child will lead them all. The cow will graze near the bear, the cub and the calf will lie down together, the lion will eat hay like a cow. The baby will play safely near the hole of a cobra. That one makes me laugh every time. Yes, a little child will put its hand in a nest of deadly snakes without harm. Nothing will hurt or destroy in all my holy mountain, for as the waters fill the sea, so the earth will be filled with people who know the Lord. This is the word of God for the people of God. Thanks be to God. Well, right there in that those first words, out of the stump of David's family. Yes, Israel was going to be reduced to a stump, but not in the same way that Assyria was. Assyria would never come back to life again. There was almost as if God had to get his people, you know, there was a leavening or a thinning out that took place in that. But that out of this, the least place you would expect, it would be like seeing trees as big as these were out front growing out of those stumps. Out of the most unlikely place was going to come one who would change. And I don't even think change is an adequate term. He would transform the world. When David was king, he was promised by God that the Messiah would come out of his family line. Out of the stump, out of the root of Jesse, the stump of David's line. And this is the line that we're talking about. In fact, you know, the book of Isaiah, most of the songs that we sing during this season that refer to the prophecies of the Messiah come from this book. And if you've ever heard the Messiah performed, we're going to read some scripture in this series. It's hard for me to not hear these words with Handel's, you know, music behind them, which makes it even bigger and grander. But this is, Isaiah is pointing specifically to this person who was to come. And scholars and all throughout church history, we have believed, and rightly so, that the one that Isaiah is referring to is Jesus. He was the shoot that would come out of the stump of the family of David. And Isaiah 11 doesn't tell us everything that we'd like to know, you know, 700 years prior, about this one who was to come, but what it does tell us is significant. And if we are going to be people who are going to follow this one who was to come, this Jesus, if we're going to recognize who he is, see how he works, and model our lives after him, every single one of these characteristics that Isaiah mentions is essential. And so the first thing that we see there about this one who was to come is he's really not going to be like anybody else. In verse 2, Isaiah tells us basically what God is, Jesus is. How God, the characteristics of God, who God is, Jesus is going to possess in himself. It reminds me of when Jesus tells his disciples not long before he leaves, before his crucifixion, you know, if you've seen me, you've seen the Father. He's not saying that egotistically. He's got some pretty good credentials to back that up. And so just as God is characterized by understanding and wisdom and as well as might and power, so is Jesus. And it's not understanding and wisdom that we have the ability to comprehend. It's not might and power that we have even seen in its full display. But it exists in Jesus. Jesus has both knowledge, he knows what to do, and he has might. He is able to do what he knows to do. We all know all sorts of people who know what to do and have absolutely no ability to carry it out. That's one type of person. We also know people who have all sorts of ability to carry things out, but no idea what to do. Jesus is not like that. He not only knows what to do, how to do it, he has the ability to pull it off. That gives me hope. That we don't serve an empty suit. That we serve a king who is wise beyond any ability to comprehend his wisdom. And he has the ability and the power to use that wisdom in ways that we just can't comprehend. And so that everything that he does flows out of that nature of who he is. And he tells his disciples in the Gospels, you know, what you see me doing, I'm not doing any of this of my own. I'm doing what my Father is doing. My Father, and so he painted a picture of him being so in divine communion with his the Creator that his actions, what he did, was just a response to who God was, because that's who Jesus was. And so that's the first thing that we see there, is that what God is, Jesus is. And we who follow Him, we're asked to live in a world that doesn't look anything like that, with this hope that the one that we're following and putting our faith in not only has the knowledge to do things, He also has the might and the power to do it. That gives us hope. The second thing we see there in verse 3 is that as God sees, Jesus sees. It says, He will delight in obeying the Lord. He will not judge by appearance, nor make a decision based on hearsay. We judge by the external. We are just by nature creatures who judge by what we see. We judge by people's appearance. We judge some by skin color. We judge by how successful someone appears to be. And I've heard it said, and I wish I could remember who said this, and you probably heard this, we don't see things as they are, we see things as we are. And the same is true for Jesus. He sees things as He is, but that gives Him the ability to see things as they are. And so as God sees, Jesus sees. And it doesn't take long reading through the Gospels to see how Jesus not only sees things as they are, He also sees things as they could be. The woman at the well. The woman brought, who was about to be stoned by a bunch of angry men. The tax collector. The leper. He sees things as they are, and He sees things in a truer sense than we could ever fathom. In fact, he sees things so clearly as they are, you'll see Him respond to thoughts. He'll be in a room, nobody will say anything, and Jesus will respond to a thought. How freaky would that be? And I can guarantee you would not be the one to speak up to say, oh yeah, that was me thinking that. And while just Him being able to see things as they are might be frightening, the hope that we have is that He not only sees that, because some of us know we're not. What we are is not what we should be. But He sees things as they can be. He acknowledges through Isaiah the difficulty. God, He doesn't paint a pretty picture for Israel. He's acknowledging that they have sinned, that they are broken, that bad things are going to happen to them. Bad things are going to happen to the people that make bad things happen to them. But He also sees things as they're going to be if the people will repent, if they'll turn, if they'll put their faith in the One who is to come. So He sees completely and utterly clearly. And that's not something to be frightened of if you're willing to accept the fact that He can also make what is into what it could be. You look at the world around you and you think, man, if God sees this even darker, if he can see this even better than I can, what's going on, but still can give us hope that things do not always have to be this way and aren't always going to be this way, that gives me hope. That God is not a cynical creator sitting in heaven. Look at all of these terrible people. If I hadn't promised not to wipe them off the face of the earth again, I would do it. That's not Him. He's like, I know what these people could be because I've made them to be something. And I've not only made them to be something, I have provided everything they need to be what I know they can be. And so as God sees, Jesus sees. Jesus sees what can be. And you know, when we read of Him tenderly approaching people in the gospel, He still has those same eyes today. It's the same set of eyes He sees us with. the potential and the hope that he sees in Matthew, that he sees in Peter, that he sees in... I like to point this out about Judas. You know, Jesus still washed Judas's feet. I think Jesus knew what Judas was going to do, but he still sees in Judas what could be. That's God saw in Paul. Paul was a terrorist. By every definition of the word, he was a terrorist. Became the greatest missionary that the church has ever known. Jesus sees what can be. I almost think those two things should be in reverse order. Jesus sees what can be. Well, you have hope there. But he sees what can be, and he has the ability and the knowledge to do what needs to be done to make things be what they can be. So what God is, Jesus is. As God sees, Jesus sees. And the third thing we see there is that as God is always just, Jesus is always just. Coming to discover in my life that just like the word hope, we use the word hope, we use the word love. Justice is one of those words that many times means something very different to us than it means to God. And I'm also, as I get older, discovering that I'm thankful that the word justice means something very different to God than it means to me. I won't comment anymore on my my feelings about certain types of justice. But I'm thankful that if it were up to me, and it's not, some things would look very different, which might not, at the end of the day, bode well for myself. But as God is always just, Jesus is always, because he has the ability to see things as they are, he has the ability to be perfectly just, and we can trust his judgment, even if it makes us uncomfortable. Isaiah prophesies that Jesus will make all things right in this world. And that's what that word justice means. Making the righting of wrongs. That's what it means at its core. But when we're talking about the justice of God, the justice of Jesus, those two words, the righting of wrongs, we have to leave it in their hands of what the writing looks like and what the wrongs are. They get to determine that. We do not get to determine that. The focus of this child's work, Isaiah prophesies, is that he will give special care to those who are poor and exploited. God has a special place in his heart for the weak, for the lowly, for the destitute, for the poor. I don't think it's an accident that the most mighty moves of God happen in the poorest parts of the world. God, there's something. It bothers me to know and understand that there are poor, there are just devastated areas of the world that happens. But man, I have that God just is drawn. I would never pray specifically to be stripped of my blessings, but I see what God does among people who aren't comfortable. And I do am tempted sometimes to just say, God, you know what? You can touch some of my comfort. We're comfortable people. Even in our uncomfortableness, we are comfortable. But God, through Isaiah, tells us there's going to come one. He's going to fix all that. The brokenness. Those who are exploited will no longer be exploited. And what's amazing about God is He's not just interested in stopping the exploitation of the exploited. He wants to transform the one doing the exploiting. This is where God's definition of justice and ours kind of gets turned on its head. We just want to lock the exploiter up and throw away the key. God says, well, you know, he's probably going to suffer some consequences, but remember, I can see what can be. And while we might not be the exploiter, there's hope in that for me, because I know even in those moments where I might not have been quite as just as I could have been, I might not have been as fair, God's justice still has something for me. His justice doesn't want to just punish me for the wrong. It wants to transform me into someone who doesn't want to do those things anymore. That's true. That's justice. That's true justice. That's how you right a wrong. You don't just rescue the one, as that's vitally important. You rescue the one who's being wrong. You change the nature of the one who was doing the wronging. That's godly justice. And it wasn't until that first Christmas that we see just how far God was willing to go to pull this off. He sent His Son to be born into a family that had nothing. In fact, when they take Him to dedicate Him in the temple, the only thing that they could afford was the offering of the poorest of the poor. They couldn't get to town in time to get a room at the inn. Were you born in a barn? Yes, he was. That's what Jesus entered the world into. Shepherds came to worship him. You've never been around a shepherd. I've never been around a shepherd. I grew up in Wyoming, Illinois, and there was a hog farm just east of the church. Rucker Meeker's Hog Farm. If there's anybody from Wyoming or that area, they know Rucker. And when you would run into one of his guys in town, you knew who you were passing. I don't think that even gets close to what a shepherd is like. They were dirty, outcasts. There was reasons that they had to be out in the middle of nowhere herding sheep. They weren't fit for anything else. That's who came to worship Jesus. Shepherds. And so that's how far God was willing to go to fulfill His promise. When Jesus ministered, He fed the hungry, He healed the sick, He forgave and transformed tax collectors and prostitutes. And the only one who could possibly know what to do, have the power to do it, to be able to see things as they are, and to be perfectly just, was God Himself. And Isaiah is telling us that there's going to come one in flesh who's going to be this for you. That's the hope that we have. And what I see Isaiah saying in these verses is that when this shoot from the stump of David came into the world, God came into the world in a way that He had never entered the world before or since. When Jesus comes into your life, God comes into your life. When Jesus speaks peace to you, God is speaking peace to you. When Jesus returns, God will be returning to complete the work that He started, to fulfill His promises. That's the meaning of this word, Advent, that we anticipate this, we celebrate this first arrival, but we are also anticipating this second arrival. And that's the meaning of this Advent word that we're talking about today, is hope. It's not hope that's uncertain. And it's hope not just of what He will be, but also of what He will do. And the hope of what He will do is that He will bring nothing short of a divine revolution. Now, I use that term, divine revolution, that's not original with me. What I mean is N.T. Wright talks about this in a lot of his writings, and we've talked about this, but maybe not with that terminology, that when Jesus came, He did not just come to save our souls. He didn't just come to get us from here to heaven. He came to bring heaven here. He came to bring the very presence of God to this world. It's a divine revolution. And verses 6 through 10 describe what the world will be like when Jesus finishes His work. The main thing the prophecy says is that the Messiah will bring perfect shalom. That word we've been using the last, peace. Not just the absence of conflict, but the presence of something. Shalom is a Hebrew word that just basically paints a picture of everything being the way it's supposed to be. Because you can have things that don't have conflict and things still aren't the way they're supposed to be. That's not the idea here. The idea is that everything is just as it should be. These verses are all about everything that is broken being brought back together. And Isaiah gives us nine kind of, depending on how you look at it, nine kind of beautiful pictures, but almost silly pictures when you think about it, about what this looks like. The wolf living with the lamb, the cow and the bear grazing peacefully side by side in a field, and the one that I chuckled, the child playing with cobras. Could you imagine me laying Lily down next to a hole in the ground with cobras in it and saying, "Hey, you guys have fun." And it's all summarized in verse 9. "Nothing will hurt or destroy in all my holy mountain, for as the waters fill the sea, so the earth will be filled with people who know the Lord." I like that last little point there, that people who know the Lord, people who know the Lord, their lives will be shaped a certain way. They will behave a certain way. I don't like to use the word behave. They'll just have a certain quality about them that doesn't exist anywhere else because they know the Lord. And there's coming a day where the earth is going to be filled with people who know the Lord. And notice that the language is about animals being reconciled to one another by a child. Isn't the way this version reads, but "and a little child shall lead them." That's how we normally hear that. And most rabbis and Old Testament scholars agree that Isaiah's pictures here that he's painting are not just about animals getting along with each other. There's something bigger that he's painting a picture of. He's taking these most vivid kind of conflicts in nature that we see and saying one day those are going to be redeemed. And if those can be redeemed, think about what else God can do. It's not just painting a word picture of the things that someday will be between all of these animals. It's saying that, but it's saying that when we become those who follow this shoot, this one who's to come, our lives will take on a very, very different nature. We will be people who know the Lord. It's a transformation for us. We need shalom too. We need not just the absence of conflict, we need the presence of everything being the way that it's supposed to be. I've been thinking about how Isaiah might tell us that looks, if he was writing today, what that might look like. He might say that the predators who have had the power in our society to harass and exploit people will no longer have that power. He'll say that one day the Fox anchor will have tea with the CNN anchor. He'll say that the millennial will dance with the Gen Xer and the baby boomer. He would say that the young African American who's had to be warned by his mother, this is a touchy one, of certain things he may have to fear in his life, will celebrate with the cop who's been warned of a very different danger. And these things that just seem so unlikely, and heaven forbid for any of us, undesirable, God's going to bring about. And the pictures that Isaiah gives us are only a touch of the radical transformation that this one who was to come is going to bring. But that's the kind of reconciliation we can expect when we place our lives in the hands of this child. Placing your lives in the hands of a child. Not my kids. But this child, who God is, he is. As God sees, he sees. As God is just, he is just. And that is where our hope is. But it only comes for those of us who place our faith in that child. It's a divine revolution. This is the hope that we have. The things that are broken are going to have their very natures altered. Man and animal alike. Verse 7, the lion will eat hay like a cow. A carnivore will become a vegetarian. Now, whether or not that's a literal picture of what's being painted, I think that's at least, you get the radical nature of what he's talking about. That means that Jesus is absolutely going to transform things. For us, it means he's going to change us from the inside out, if we'll let him. We do have some say in this. It would be nice if he could just do it without my consent and just get it done, but that's not how he's chosen to work. He comes into our lives to begin to change us until you and I are fully conformed into His image. God promises that will happen. We're still waiting on the completion of that. But again, it's not an empty hope. It's not an uncertain hope that we have. So this is the hope that comes down to earth at Advent. It's promised, but it's not quite yet finished in our experience. We now live in this in-between time where we celebrate the first coming of Jesus and we anticipate his second coming. And God's message at Advent to all of us is an encouragement to wait with hope. Because we see bits and we see signs of what God can do, what He's ultimately going to finish. We see signs of that. That's what keeps our hope going. Is that God's not just holding it out here like a carrot. He's given us it's an encouragement to wait with hope in this world until Jesus returns and finishes His work. And as we wait to allow Him to do His life-transforming work in our lives, the Word has come to fulfill the meaning of this word, hope. Amen?